Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, best-selling author and journalist Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we once again prepare to dive into the crypt and unearth another story for your ingestion. This week we are looking at the case of Roche Terrio, leader of the infamous Canadian cult, the Ant Hill Kids. Before we get going, however, I have the normal show notes. If you would like to follow me on social media, just search for Ian Totten, author, or The Deathcast. You can find me on most social media sites. If you would like to sign up to the show's mailing list, just go to CorpseCreekPublishing.com and click on the sign up button. While you're there, please consider making a donation to the show. Buy me a cup of coffee or a pack of smokes. No amount is too small, and obviously no amount is too large. If you are interested in becoming a Patreon member to get access to exclusive content, just go to tinyurl.com/DCPatreon. For as little as $2 a month, you can help support the production of this show. And lastly, if you really like what I do, please consider going to your favorite podcast app, subscribing to the show, and leaving a 5-star review. We do have one this week from Nathan, who asked me to just give him a shout-out. He said he enjoys the show, so there you go, Nathan. Alright, now that all of that is out of the way, get yourself something to drink, find a nice comfy chair, I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes, let's go into the crypt. So a couple of things on this particular case. Most of the individuals involved were French-Canadian, such as the main perpetrator, Roche Terrio, and I don't speak French, so I apologize in advance for any of my Americanized pronunciations. I also want to give a bit of a trigger warning, as the Ant Hill Kids performed some pretty horrific actions against one another. So much so that, you know, hearing graphic descriptions of abuse upsets you, you might want to skip this particular episode. On February 26, 2011, a 63-year-old inmate by the name of Roche Terrio was found dead inside of his cell at the Dorchester Penitentiary, which is located in Dorchester, New Brunswick. And Dorchester Penitentiary is considered a medium security facility. Basically, what happened is that another inmate, Matthew Gerald MacDonald, who was a 60-year-old convicted murderer, had been sharing a cell with Roche, and some type of altercation came about, and the man just decided he'd had enough of his cellmate, so he ended up taking a shiv and stabbing the man in the neck before walking from his cell to the guards and informing them of what he had done, stating, quote, "That piece of shit is down on the range. Here's the knife. I've sliced him up." Obviously, this man ended up being sentenced. He got another life sentence for second-degree murder, but it was the end of a long series of brutality and violent acts by Roche Terrio. And as you're going to see, really was a fitting end for this individual. Roche Terrio was born in the Saguenay Valley of Quebec on May 16, 1947, to Yassant and Pierrette Terrio. He was the second of seven children born to the family, and the eldest son. Yassette is said to have been a deeply religious man who worked as a laborer and was a member of the Union of Electors, also known as the White Berets, which was a fascist Catholic organization which had splintered off from another group, the Credeste, at some point during the Great Depression. And it's been said that his father's devoutness to the religion as well as this movement instilled in young Roche a deep-seated hatred for Catholicism, as well as organized religions in general, which is odd considering the fact that Roche was aligned for a period of time with an organized religion once he reached adulthood. I think it's more a case of Roche, who was a very intelligent boy, seeing that his father was controlled by this organization, and that by being controlled by this organization and sent out to do their work, it took the father away from the family. And this organization that his father belonged to, these White Berets, were the type of organization that would go door to door proselytizing, much as Jehovah's Witnesses do, which, coupled with the fact that he was a day laborer and also had six other children, leads me to speculate that the father probably did not have much time for his oldest son. I think that he being Roche, saw that this organization was a means to control others, and he wanted to be the one that was in control, not the one who was being controlled. And you're going to see, as we go through his childhood quickly, he picked up on how to do this fairly quickly. It's been said that Roche Thériault really didn't have much in the way to complain about as he was growing up. All of his needs were met. And once they moved from Saguenay Valley to the Thetford Mines area of the Eastern Valleys, the school in the Thetford Mines only went up to the 7th grade, therefore none of the Thériault children got any sort of education beyond this, which left them with a lot of time on their hands once school was over, as they pretty quickly had to go out and join the workforce, and would lead Roche to discover that he was very good at manipulating people. It's been stated that he learned early on that if he complained about his childhood or his home life, others would show sympathy to him, and he used this to get things from them. You couple that with the fact that Roche was said to have very eclectic interests, which he used to kind of make himself appear to be more intelligent than he actually was, led the young man to a point in his life where attention from others really was the only driving force in his life. And I think that really has a lot to do with the fact that his father was not there quite often, as he was out proselytizing for the religious order. So, because he couldn't get the attention that he needed at home, he began to crave the attention and admiration of those in the outside world. One of the things that Roche discovered would draw people to him was if he began to speak about spiritual matters, which, given the area that he was living in, which was very small town, cut off from most of, normal society, was easy enough to do. The people in these areas, they didn't have what I'm going to term as big city ideas. It's more likely than not that there was a lot of superstition in the area that he grew up in, and speaking on spiritual matters would spark these fears within the townsfolk, but also draw them to him as they wanted to hear what it was that he had to say. On November 11th of 1967, Roch, who was 20 years old and was working as a laborer, ended up marrying a young woman from the next town over by the name of Francine Granier. And not long after they married, the couple decided to move to Montreal. And I have to imagine that moving to such a large city, given their backgrounds, had to have been a bit of a shock to the young couple. In Montreal, Roch was able to find some means of employment as his wife proceeded to bear him children. At some point during all of this, Roch developed pretty severe ulcers to the point that he had to seek doctors to help him with them. They actually performed surgeries on him. These did not, in fact, help with the issue. It's said that because of this, Roch transitioned from being a Catholic to joining the Seventh-day Adventists, which at the time, I don't know if they still do or not, practiced a good amount of holistic medicine, which he found fascinating. Also, according to numerous sources, Roch began studying numerous medical textbooks in order to further his knowledge on the subject of human anatomy and how to treat various diseases and issues. Around 1969-1970, the Theriots moved back to the Thetford Mines, where Roch began taking up work as a skilled woodworker, as well as following in his father's footsteps and joining in local politics. One of the groups that he aligned himself with is the Le Club Aramis, which was pretty much like the Shriners. And some sources state that Theriot, while within this organization, began practicing something that was in line with a mockery of Christianity. What exactly this entailed, I'm not certain. It is known, though, that during this period of transition in his life, Roch began to drink heavily. And this started almost immediately to affect his already irritable personality. But it also led him into experimenting with sex. And by that I mean having sex with multiple partners who were not his spouse. And this caused something of a riff in his family, as obviously his wife wants him to be faithful, but also led his in-laws to become agitated with him as well. Some sources state that basically Roch would take his woodworking skills and head out to Quebec on the weekends, where he was ostensibly trying to sell the various things that he was making, but was in reality having affairs behind his wife's back. Eventually, Francine left Roch, and he ended up in a relationship with a woman by the name of Giselle. And here we kind of see the duality of his personality. He's carrying on these various affairs. He's involved with one woman after his wife leaves him, but he's trying to keep up some form of public appearance, as he has been stated to tell many who would listen that he had very high moral standards and scruples. So Rook goes so far as to set up a bed in the back of his truck to make it appear to any passerby that he has such high moral standards, he cannot bring himself to have sex with this woman who he's in a relationship with, as they are not married. Now remember, he'd already been tangentially dealing with the Seventh-day Adventists. Well, the organization, or the group of them that he was dealing with, met on Saturdays in a local motel room. He threw himself into this organization pretty heavily during this period of time. And the Seventh-day Adventists, they practiced living clean lifestyles, which meant no drinking, no bad food, no smoking. Rook took these upon himself, and for a period of time, it seemed as though he was almost a religious zealot, to the point that other members of this small congregation began to become worried about Rook, as he particularly latched on to the ideas of very strong male masculinity and authority over society and the household, and the doomsday aspect of their beliefs. This he took from the Old Testament. As time wore on and Rook began, you know, really irritating and upsetting other members of this particular sect with his boastfulness, Rook began to sell their tracts from door to door in order to make money. He was so good at this work, and possibly as a way to placate him, the head of this sect gave Rook another responsibility, and that was to oversee workshops to help other members of the Seventh-day Adventists quit smoking, which he excelled at as well. And it's during this period of time, now we're moving into the mid to late 70s, that Rook began to amass a small congregation of followers within the larger Seventh-day Adventist movement. These include Solange Bollard, Chantal Lebre, Francine Laflamme, Nicole Rule, José Pelletier, Jaco Feast, Claude Ouellette, as well as a married couple by the name of Georges Grégoire and his wife Maurice. And this didn't go unnoticed by other members of the Seventh-day Adventists, but to them it was keeping Rook out of their hair, because he was spending more and more time with these individuals and less time with them, which allowed them to focus on, you know, spiritual matters and that type of thing. And they reason that if he's got this small group within their group that is, you know, hanging out and following him, he's still doing the Lord's work. What they didn't know, however, is that Rook and his followers were meeting over at Giselle's apartment, where he began to pontificate to them on his worldly vision. And he pretty quickly began to take over these individuals' lives. He had a heavy influence on them, as most of his followers were in their late teens to early 20s, and Rook was, you know, around 30 years of age. He began encouraging them to drop out of college and quit their jobs, that type of thing, which if you have followed or looked into cults in any fashion is really standard fare for cult leaders to do. It just seems that Rook was able to do these things much quicker than most. One of the ways that he was able to encourage them to follow his ideology was by telling them that the end times are going to be coming soon, so all of these things that you're getting involved with, they really don't matter. See, you might as well just stop all of that stuff and come with me, and we can prepare for Christ's return. It's said in some sources that Giselle began to resent the female members of Ruch's circle, but she tempered this with the fact that he had expressed interest in eventually becoming a priest within the Seventh-day Adventists movement, and also that he was living a life of complete sobriety by this point. So it wasn't very likely that he would give in to the temptations of the flesh. At some point during 1977, Ruch and his followers went to an Adventists retreat on Lake Rosseau in Muskoka, Ontario, where he met further followers. Ruch was taken by the majestic scenery that he encountered at the lake, and at one point during this retreat, he actually left the others and went on a hike to the top of a hillside where, upon a rocky outcropping, he later told followers that God had spoken to him and given him a vision of the sky lit up white with flames, telling him that this was a holy place for he and his followers alone. When Ruch told his believers about this, they were further ensnared to him. And he would have many more of these prophetic visions throughout the years, but this is the first documented one, wherein he claimed that God himself had spoken to him. And these young individuals, already enamored by the man who has been said to be extremely charismatic, now they began to see him as something of a prophet or a messiah. Similar, I suppose, in the way that Jim Jones's followers viewed him. Not long after this vision, Ruch decided that the group needed to move away from the Thérault mines, and they settled in an area south of Quebec City. Once there, they opened up a store called the Healthy Living Clinic, where people could come in for holistic medicine as well as organic foods, and Ruch could further oversee the lives of his followers. He began demanding that they all wear uniforms. The women would wear green ankle-cut tunics, while the men would wear beige tunics, and Ruch himself would wear a brown tunic to symbolize that he was one of, but apart from the others. You see this kind of thing quite often in cults, where the leader needs to inform everyone who encounters them that he is different from the normal followers. He's special. He's an anointed one. And Ruch was very good at this, putting himself up on a pedestal from all of the others. New members to the group that came in during this period of time would sell all of their worldly possessions in order to help fund this clinic and fill the organization's coffers. And at least according to some accounts, Ruch and his followers were living fairly comfortably. I mean, they weren't multimillionaires or anything like that, but they had the money to get the necessities that they needed, as well as you know, keep up with the store, but also to spread their word further afield from the clinic. The popularity that Rook was seeing during this period of time, especially among young women, really started to eat at Gazelle, and she eventually decided that the only way she could keep him from straying afield was to marry him. So she proposed, and a week later, Rook ended up accepting this proposal, and the two were married on January 8th, 1978, at an Adventist church in Montreal. Some accounts have it that during the five-hour trek back to the clinic after this marriage, Rook pretty much ignored his new bride and instead focused his attention on the young women in the van. One account has it that Gazelle cried the entire night of their, what should have been their honeymoon, on a mattress, as she came to the realization that Rook had only married her in an effort to show that he was loyal and sincere to the Seventh-day Adventists' cause. This eventually led the head of the particular sect of Adventists that Rook and his followers were attached to decide that they needed to break up this commune that he was building around him, with this individual going to many of the parents of his followers, as well as to Rook's new bride, in an effort to persuade them away from him. Unfortunately, though, he was too well entrenched in their minds at this point for the man to be successful. This escalated, though, as families began to contact the police in an effort to get their loved ones out from under Rook's thumb. However, every time the police would show up at the Healthy Living Clinic, the girls would refuse to speak with them, instead allowing Rook to speak for them. Even small businesses in the area began to approach the police, stating that he has outstanding bills with us, you need to do something about this. They were unable to break through the wall of silence that Rook had built around him. In March of 1978, a young woman by the name of Geraldine Auclair went to the Healthy Living Clinic. Geraldine had been suffering from leukemia, and at the insistence of her husband, she gave in and decided to try the holistic remedies that the Healthy Living Clinic was promoting. Basically, the story is that Geraldine's husband had asked Rook to go to the hospital to see his wife. While there, Rook got into an argument with a number of doctors who were overseeing the 38-year-old woman's care, particularly in regards to the amount of drugs that Geraldine was being given. After meeting with Geraldine, Rook goes back to the husband and says, you know, we can help her, but we can't do it in her current setting. You need to check her out of the hospital and into the Healthy Living Clinic, where we can help. And her husband does this to the protestations of both the doctors as well as Geraldine's father. Obviously, Geraldine, now bereft of the doctor's care, did not last long in the clinic, as Rook's treatment for her was organic food and grape juice. And when Geraldine eventually died, Rook went to his followers and told them that he had kissed her, bringing her back to life briefly. ending his statement to them with, quote, "You know, when God wants people, he takes them. It was Geraldine's time." More people began bringing sick loved ones to the Healthy Living Clinic as Roque was building up something of a reputation in the area as a faith healer. Some of this may have been because he was so well read on the human body and medicine that he was able to find everyday cures, so to speak, to less severe issues that individuals were having, or that he was able to get individuals who may have had something that was more severe, such as, say, diabetes, he was able to get them into a healthier lifestyle, and this lessened the problems and the symptoms that they were experiencing. It's almost like a carny trick that he was pulling on these individuals, acting as though, you know, he was this great man of God by just doing simple things that would take away their symptoms or lessen them, to the point that others began hearing about him and believing that he was, in fact, you know, a holy man healer. But not everyone was blinded by his shtick. The Seventh-day Adventists eventually decided that Roque needed to go, and they voted him out of the religious movement. This obviously did nothing to slow down Roque's momentum, as not long after being removed from the Seventh-day Adventists, he decided that he and he alone should be the determining factor in his followers' lives. He began to pair the women up with the men, stressing to them that they must be subservient to these men and then marrying them. This despite the fact that oftentimes the women had no attraction whatsoever to the men that Roque decided that they would be with. So you can see how quickly he has escalated the control over his followers' lives. When you compare him to someone like Jim Jones, it's almost astounding that he was able to get control of them so completely and quickly, whereas Jones, it took years and years of both building his organization and working on the minds of his followers to achieve similar results. Not long after these marriages were performed, Gisele decided that she could no longer take her husband's growing popularity, and she gave him an ultimatum. He was either to break up their commune and let these individuals go on with their lives, or she was going to leave him and head back to live with her father. Roque's response was to punch her in the face before forbidding her from leaving the room that she was in for 2 days, which, at least from what I could find, Gisele heeded his demands and stayed inside of this room. It's a good indication and window into the type of individual that Roque was becoming, and the sway that he held over people that, after beating his wife, she acquiesced to what he wanted and did not press back against him. In June of 1978, Roque decided that they needed to shutter the Healthy Living Clinic. This was due to numerous reasons, such as their outstanding debts, the police presence around the clinic following Eau Claire's death. But the biggest reason was the fact that, now cut off from the Seventh-day Adventists, he could no longer get his hands on the literature and healthy foods that they had been selling to make their living. So Roche decides that the entire commune needs to move away. And they basically took on kind of a hippie nomadic lifestyle. During this period, Roche expressed to his followers that he had had visions, claiming that the world would end on February 17th, 1979, in catastrophic events of biblical proportions. He further stated that those within the commune would at this point be anointed as God's chosen people and would be allowed to continue existing as they had been, but only if they chose to follow Rook's guidance and live life as he prescribed to them. And it was at this point that the group set off into the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. On July 11th of 1978, they found themselves on a small hillside near an area called Dry Lake, which Rook dubbed the Eternal Mountain, and it was here that his group of followers set up camp, building a shanty town and later constructing a communal center for them. Some who were within the movement said that they were worked like dogs at this point, spending upwards of 17 hours a day constructing this communal sentence. Well, Rook oversaw the operation and began to ration their food. He began to take a much harder line towards his followers at this point, where any infraction or complaint could result in them being restricted from eating. A handful of followers left at this point of time, with Rook doing nothing to stop them, instead proclaiming to those who had remained behind that those individuals who had left had proven themselves to be unbelievers and unworthy of God's grace, dubbing them evil in the eyes of the Lord. When the communal center slash cabin was completed, Rook dubbed himself Mose, or Moses, proclaiming that he had been designated by God to lead his chosen people forward, while Giselle was renamed Mammy. One thing of interest to note is that at this point, late September, early October, the organization was subsiding strictly on the welfare checks that the members were getting. How they were able to swindle the Canadian government of this money, I really have no idea, but I'm sure that Rook helped them to concoct the stories that they would use in order to receive these funds. Not long after this revelation, or so it said, Giselle related to her husband that many of the girls who had not been married off by him were lonely, and he related this to them, which, if you know anything about cults, you understand where this is leading. It's really a tactic by Rook to get into these girls' pants. When Giselle learned of her husband's infidelities, she attempted to leave the commune, but he tracked her down, knocking her to the ground, and began to squeeze the life out of her with his hands by grabbing her by the throat and choking her, until Giselle agreed to return to the commune with him. So he's got everything going on at this point. He's got complete control of his followers and their lives. He's got the women bowing down to him and fulfilling any sexual fantasy that he may have, and he's also beginning to abuse them in various ways. At this point, though, the biggest target of this abuse is his wife, with the other followers really being restricted to food rationings. But it gets better, so to speak. He decides at this point that all of the marriages which he had forced upon his followers, and even those who were legally married, they were all void. And he now begins to marry the women to himself, which, of course, just further allowed him to have intercourse with the women as he saw fit, and deprived the men within the commune of any release for the sexual urges that they may have been feeling. Roch began pontificating and claiming to have had visions. One such vision involved the Jonestown massacre in Guyana, which he said God had shown to him as proof that unbelievers would be struck down by his wrath, which apparently his followers ate up. They did not question the fact that Roch claimed to have had his vision of the People's Temple downfall a year prior, yet had not filled any of them in on it. Had any of these young people who were under his sway questioned him on this, it would have led to some form of violence from Roch and some of the others towards that individual, but it may have actually woken up some of the others as to the fact that he was claiming to have visions after the fact of something occurring. Because of the People's Temple situation in Guyana, many of the outside loved ones of Roch's followers really began trying to get their family members to return to them, as they could see what others could not, and that is that Roch was nothing more than a cult, charismatic cult leader. Eventually, this led the police to the commune's cabin, where they were stymied for what to do, as they really had no grounds by which to take Roch into custody. He wasn't presenting himself to be a danger to himself and or to others. Roch, though, feeling his oats, decided to go with the officers, where they basically hit him with a psychological evaluation and interrogated him. Roch downplayed his role within the cult, claiming that he was nothing more than a member of it, and that in fact the organization was a democratic society whose goal was to, quote, live in peace and without any promiscuity. The police, unable to do anything, obviously had to let Roch go back to his commune, although they did keep periodic watches on the organization, mostly at the behest of family members who were adamant that their loved ones were in a cult and that this man was controlling them. And it's from this point onward that Roch begins to spiral. He begins drinking again. He starts eating meat and other food that their diet had previously prohibited, but he also begins to prostitute out various females from his congregation to the locals to get things such as bread, milk, fruit, eggs, and delivering drunken sermons to his followers who were forbidden from falling asleep while he pontificated. His level of abuse began to escalate as well. He began clubbing members in the side of the head for the slightest of infractions, and at one point broke two of his legal wife's ribs after she ate more food than he had told her she was allowed to have. He would also begin to degrade his followers. One of his favorite punishments was to have them strip naked in the winter and stand for long hours out in the snow, a demonstration to the others of both their repentance for whatever the infraction was, but also as a show of their commitment to Rook and his prophetic visions. One of the keys to all of this is the food deprivation, which I've already discussed off and on throughout this. He really began restricting what people could eat, how much, and when. And as science will tell you, when you began to deprive individuals of the basic nutrients that the body needs, it starts to affect the mind, making individuals susceptible to suggestion as well as easily controllable. And Rook was able to use this to get his followers to really do whatever it was that he wanted, even going so far as to have them write letters to him any time that they strayed from his rationing program. It actually puts me in mind to how communist Russia, back under the Stalin era, when they would arrest somebody that they were going to put on a show trial, this individual, so desperate to get back in the good graces of Stalin, would write these long, rambling letters to him, professing their allegiance to him, while at the same time apologizing for the transgression that he claimed they had perpetrated. And this gave Rook further control over his followers, much as it did Stalin, and made it very easy for him to further break their will. One story that has come out about the cult is that at one point one of the female followers decided that she was going to leave, and Rook instructed her legal husband to cut off one of her toes with an axe as punishment. When the man began to balk at this idea, Rook began to taunt him fairly heavily, basically asking him if he was gay and if he lacked the intestinal fortitude to do what God had prescribed him to accomplish. When the man began to cry after this verbal assault, Rook picked up the axe himself and stated he was going to cut off all of the women's toes himself, at which time this man relented and went and did as his Messiah had instructed. From this point on, this individual, Jacques Guiguire, became the main muscle within the commune. When the day of the coming judgment passed without any end coming to the world, Rook claimed to his followers that it was very difficult for a normal human being to divine exact dates from the heavens, and that time passed differently for him as it did for other people. Apparently, this was enough for the individuals to stay firmly entrenched by Rook's side. In March of 1979, the police descended upon Eternal Mountain and took Rook into custody for obstruction of justice. So Rook is sent to a mental hospital for evaluation, and he leaves his wife in charge, and she is able to keep the thing running while holding the various cult members' families at bay. While in this institution, Roke shows again his ability to manipulate others as doctors within the hospital begin to refer to him as Mose, even in their written notes concerning him. And he's very quickly able to convince the doctors that he has saved all of these people who are following him from lives filled with drug abuse and promiscuity and various other social ills, and that without him, many of those who were following him would more likely than not be living on the streets of major cities, if not dead. These doctors believe him, and they begin to push back against the forces of the outside world, claiming that Roke had, in fact, done nothing wrong, and that he was simply being targeted because he chose to live a different type of lifestyle than those of mainstream society. He was such an exquisite manipulator that Roke was able to get the media to start painting him in as rosy colors as the doctors were, calling him basically a simple mountain man who was part of a democratic society who simply wanted to live their lives free from the normal constraints of society without any of their oversight. I have to imagine that these portrayals of Roke are one of the reasons that when he was finally put on trial, he was simply given a 1-year suspended sentence and sent back to the commune, at which point he continued to oversee the lives of his followers. In 1979, one of the cult's followers died, and authorities pushed back against Roke's desire to bury the young woman at the foot of the mountain. They performed an autopsy, which really found that nothing outside the ordinary had happened. The young woman had simply died from natural causes. In November of 1980, an individual by the name of Guy Veer joined the group. And Veer is said to have suffered from extreme bouts of depression and was also seen as being mentally unfit, meaning he had various mental illnesses that no amount of ministering from Roke's people would be able to alleviate. This led to the first known death by abuse within the commune, as Roke's 2 children from his first marriage were sent by their mother to live with him. And on the night that these children arrived, Veer was excluded from this party. Now, Veer, again, remember I said he had mental issues. They were such that Roke decided that he could stay with them, but he could not be really a part of the commune. He was given a woodshed to live in, various rations, which basically included, you know, a meal a day and cases of homebrewed beer. His jobs were basically to watch over the children of the commune who had not been fathered by Roche himself. And this is what led to the incident I'm about to describe. On the night of Roach's 2 children arriving to the commune, apparently Veer went to sleep when one of the children, a 2-year-old by the name of Samuel, began crying incessantly. Now, this child was under Veer's stewardship, as Roche had not fathered this child. In fact, the boy was the offspring of Roche's main enforcer within the commune. After screaming at the boy to stop crying, Veer became incensed, picked the young boy up, and began punching him into the face to the point that the child went unconscious. Now, according to court testimony, the following day, Roche was made aware of this situation and went to minister to the child. He found the young boy's head flopping back on its neck, which is an indication that it probably had a broken neck. But he also found that the boy's penis had become swollen and engorged. And to alleviate this symptom, he basically, and I apologize, there's really no other way to say it, he lanced the boy's penis in order to allow the flow of urine to come out of his body. Obviously, Roach has no idea what he's doing, and this boy sadly died the following day. However, another story that came out from a commune member is that the boy was beaten, but he wasn't dead. His neck hadn't been broken. But that Roque, upon seeing this boy, who he considered an animal as he had not fathered the child, decided that he was going to perform a circumcision on this boy. And to do this, he used ethanol alcohol to sterilize the razor that he was going to do, but he also filled up a rubber bulb and filled it with this ethanol alcohol solution, squeezing it into the young boy's mouth as a form of anesthesia. And according to this version of the story, the child actually died from alcohol poisoning. After the child's death, his parents showed little to no emotion, and it was decided that this young child would be buried on the commune grounds over fears that animals might get to the remains. So they buried the remains and went back to things as they had previously been. Eventually, Roche, who was increasingly consuming alcohol, decided that Veer should stand trial for his crime, with various members of his extended family serving different parts within the trial. Veer ended up not being found not guilty by reason of insanity, but Roche was not satisfied with this judgment, and he decided that Veer should be castrated. After informing Veer that this was to be his punishment, and letting him know that he should sign a letter of consent, but, you know, they wouldn't complain should he not, Veer did sign this letter. The young man laid down on a kitchen table, at which point a rubber band was placed over Veer's testicles and they were removed. Amazingly, Veer survived this, although Rook was still incensed for some reason at this man and began tormenting him at every chance, beating him mercilessly whenever he could. This led to Veer escaping from the commune and heading to a nearby village, where he told authorities that a baby had been kicked to death by a horse. This led to Rock and the child, who's the child that had had his penis lanced by Rook, the parents ended up being arrested as well. It was at this point the police learned that Veer had beaten the child severely, and they also discovered the boy's body along with the letter of consent that Veer had signed. Rock and various members of the commune ended up being charged with negligence in regards to this young boy's death, and eventually all of them were found guilty. So Rock ends up getting basically 2 years in prison, while other members of the commune get various prison terms, and they're forced off of their land, which would later be raised by the local police department. So while Rock is sitting in prison, his followers move into apartments within Quebec City so that they could still be close to him. But as this is part one of a two-part series, you already know that this is not going to be the end of the group that came to be known as the Ant Hill Kids. And in fact, it's about to get a whole lot worse when we get into part two. I am going to cut the story off at this point. I'd like to thank you for listening and remind you to please leave a 5-star review wherever it is you get your favorite podcasts. Until next time, the Deathcast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing. Stay morbid.